podcast, The Worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 27 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today is a slightly different one because, it's Easter. So I thought, you know, a lot of people aren't really going to be around, particularly in the UK. And I didn't want to have someone take the trouble to do an interview with me and then have it sort of not disappear, but, you know, some people don't really engage with blogs and podcasts when they're on holiday, understandably. So I've been sort of thinking about this for a few weeks, and I wanted to do one of just of me, not because it's of me, but because I had a few thoughts for blog posts recently, but I thought I just can't be bothered to write them down, and it might be more fun to make it an episode of a podcast instead. So if you've read the blog bit, I haven't written it yet, but I imagine it'll be some sort of rundown of what this podcast is going to be about. But there were three things I wanted to talk about, and they seem kind of related to each other. So I thought I'll talk about one and see if they segue into the next and then the next. But those three things, in possibly chronological order, are the Kendall Jenner Pepsi ad, which seems to have attracted a lot of negative attention for Pepsi, and diversity, which I think is an interesting subject, partly because, well, lots of people are talking about it, but I don't know if they mean what I mean or we all mean the same thing. And then the third thing was a column Ian Hartfield, who I've known for quite a while since he was at AMV in the early 2000s. We were at AMV at the same time. That he wrote a campaign talking about doing good advertising. By good advertising, I mean non-negative advertising, something that brings something positive into the world, and why that's more important now than at other times. So let's start with the Pepsi ad. I mean, I was sort of, maybe going to do this and then a bit reluctant because it's been talked about by so many people and everyone's had their hot take and their cold take and their medium take on it. And what have I got to add? What have I got to say? Well, let's see. I don't know. I've made a Pepsi ad, so I've got a little bit of experience of it. Because the first thing that occurred to me about this, well, I guess the first thing that occurred to me was it's kind of shit. In a lot of different, slightly weird ways. I mean, the whole cloth-eared, leaden attempt to jump on the back of the current vibe for, you know, protest and activism and things like that it was just done quite poorly. I mean, I think you probably could do something like that. I think a lot of people mentioned that Coke did that. I'd like to buy the world a Coke, and, you know, the world wasn't up in arms. It was a different world then. You know, I guess it was still in the middle of the Vietnam War when that ad came out, but it wasn't directly jumping on the back of protests. And I think for that reason, it wasn't really going to offend people that much. And this one, because it so directly references not just, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and many of the protests that have gone on in the recent months, both in the UK and in the US and other parts of the world. And then it directly seems to reference that famous photo of the woman getting arrested at the Black Lives Matter protest when Kendall Jenner gives over the Pepsi can to the police guy. Anyway, so I didn't like all that particularly. That's just my own opinion. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying I didn't really like it. It didn't really work for me. But the thing that I found amazing, having been within that process at some point, is how many people must have approved that ad before it got on air. And I've seen this a few times. And if you ever see it happening for a good client, for a big corporation, and whether you've worked in a big agency or not, you'll know it went from the brain of a copywriter or art director out of his mouth into the ear of another, the copywriter or art director of the creative team working together. And they had a chat, and maybe it went to a group creative director type person, and then maybe it went to the executive creative director type person, all the while also being seen and evaluated by the planners and the account management people. And on an account like Pepsi, probably some very, very senior people at the agency, perhaps even the president. I think, and maybe I read somewhere that this was made by some internal department. But anyway, there's still going to be those layers of people. And then you get to the client, and it'd be very unusual for there to be one or two layers of client. Usually you'll have three or four of them evaluating whether it's exactly right for Pepsi, and they'll make some changes and they go, I like this idea, but could you change it to that idea? We've all had client comments. And then it goes through to a production company, a director, if not several production companies and directors. You know, most things get at least triple bid these days. So you'll have had the feedback of many other talented creative people who will have said, this is good or this is bad, or I do it this way or I do it that way. And then they ended up with a director, I'm not sure who it was, and he shot those things in that way. And, you know, let's just take, for example, the photographer in the hijab element of it. I don't know who or where that came up, or whether they just thought the basic plot was these people, ethnically diverse people coming together to, you know, collectively show ways of being creative that are tangentially, vaguely possibly to do with Pepsi, not at all, really. And then when that idea came up, nobody said, isn't this really going to look like we're kind of going for a bit of tokenism? Then on the flip side, I'm sure someone also said, I think we should have someone in a hijab because, you know, we need to represent, you know, the whole world. We shouldn't just represent, say, African-American or Caucasian, lots of Caucasian. Let's make sure we represent everybody. So the intentions are probably really good. And that may well be why nobody held their hand up and went, this is just going to look really crass. And it's difficult to know whether it's going to look crass until it's actually been shot and you put it all together. But then add that Ziggy Marley music as well. So we're going to jump on the back of a bit of reggae. In isolation, all these things, you know, are they that bad? I don't know. It's when you put it all together and it feels like Pepsi have done a sort of join the dots picture of 2017 multiculturalism on the back of trying to sell brown sugary water, that I think people are just, no, these things really mean something to us. You can't just co-opt them as a giant corporation for the purpose of making millions and millions of pounds or dollars or whatever it is. We don't want you to do that because these are things we hold dear. So there was all that going on. I think the other thing I found interesting afterwards was the general chatter about it being a Kendall Jenner Pepsi ad. And the reason I found that interesting was because I'm kind of going, oh, is she that famous? Is she this big name now where, you know, if you said it was a Pharrell ad or a Kanye ad or any of that, you get that. But I didn't realize perhaps that Kendall Jenner was so famous that this ad is called the Kendall Jenner Pepsi ad, not the protest Pepsi ad, it's called the Kendall Jenner Pepsi ad. And not only that, Pepsi, when they apologized for making it, first they apologized for making it, and very soon after, in brackets, was we also apologized to Kendall Jenner for putting her in this position. Now, going back to my other point, Kendall Jenner's people, again, this people who would have been very expensive, very high up, very senior, all thought it was the right thing for her to do, including her, and assuming she's a woke millennial or whatever we want to call these people these days. And then her mum, who, you know, rules the Jenner family, as far as I've seen, the Kardashian family, with an iron fist of at least marketing and imagery, where she doesn't want anything to damage all that. And seems to have done a very, very good job of it. You know, I don't know the Kardashian thing that well, but you could, they're everywhere. The ubiquity of the Kardashians is quite incredible. And so this is the latest example of that. And Pepsi felt compelled to apologize to her. And I don't know if that was that came down from them. Well, they want to use her in future. And then, you know, maybe she's been signed up for 5 years to be their person. And therefore, they needed to go out and put that apology so that she didn't take all the heat for it. I don't know. But it's just another element of another big bunch of people who would have approved something that seems a bit, you know, not worth approving, or at least, hang on everybody, let's stop here. Should we be co-opting the protest movements that are going on right now that people are taking very seriously and are very heartfelt about, just so we can sell our Pepsi? So that all went a bit wrong for those reasons. And I haven't really seen that take on it, which is why I'm talking about it. All the reasons why it's been poorly constructed and shot and led, and, you know, I think we've all seen all that. But I don't understand how it got through this many people all the way to air whilst, you know, it must have been shown to dozens of people around the agency or the client or whatever. And either no one wanted to say it, no one felt the courage to put their hands up and say, that emperor's not wearing any clothes. Or they genuinely thought there was no problem with it and were very surprised by the public's reaction. Don't know, one or the other. And here we are. I think it's fascinating that you can get a consensus from some very, very experienced senior people in a situation, in a world or an industry like advertising, and have them all get it not just wrong, but enormously wrong. I think that's fascinating because, you know, if Pepsi and all their army of people involved, including Kendall Jenner's people and everyone else, can get it that wrong, then if any of you are making a banner ad for, you know, your local chip shop, then the ability to get that wrong is obviously going to be, you think, far, far higher than all the armies of Pepsi. So if they can screw it up, we can all screw it up, I think, is what I'm saying. And I find that kind of fascinating. No matter how you try to protect the process, it's still art and it's still being put out there to a lot of people. And you can't in any way dictate how your art is going to be consumed or what people's reaction is going to be. So whether you're a painter or a filmmaker or someone who works in advertising, you just don't know. And we're all still in that position, and the best laid plans of mice and men can go very awry. So that was the first thing I wanted to talk about. The second thing is diversity, and I mentioned this a little bit in my chat with Shaka in the episode 26. Is this I never get the numbers right. Last week, anyway, the one with Shaka. So we talked about diversity, and ever since I started the podcast, you know, I've been very aware that most of the people who I could talk to, I want to talk to, have been white middle-aged guys, partly because of the kind of age thing. The people who were my heroes when I started in advertising, or as I went through further years of it, they tended to be white guys who are now middle-aged, and that's fine because that's one demographic, no problem. But I wanted very much to make sure I featured as many women as possible, and also ethnic diversity, because, you know, the order it goes in terms of diversity is gender diversity, which seems to be, you know, the agency I've been working at for the last 6 years has been at least 50-50 women, and I've met a lot of women in advertising, and maybe it's changed a bit over the years, and that's definitely becoming more of a balance. It may be different in creative departments. You know, there's been plenty of conversations about why creative departments are still, in terms of the percentage representation, are still fairly low as far as women are concerned, because, you know, all the theories about whether women are happy to do the pot noodle bed sit time of being on placement, and maybe they're not so keen or interested in doing it. Maybe they've got better things to do. No offense to advertising, but, you know, women might take one look at advertising and go, well, I'm actually a little bit above this, or bright for this, or this isn't really my thing, or I don't know. I'm trying to, I guess, be more positive about, you know, whether women will really want to be in advertising. I don't know. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I think it's still the case that in terms of the creative department, it's mainly men by a fairly obvious factor. So there's that. But overall, in ad agencies, I feel like the balance is pretty close. then the next diversity thing you get, they're probably quite close to each other, because this is the thing. People throw out the word diversity all the time in the same way, and I said this again, I said this to Shaka, in the same way they throw out digital. What does digital mean? We just say digital now to mean a million different things. You know, ads that appear in the digital landscape, you know, online, that kind of stuff. But also, it's really advertising that, that isn't the four non, the four traditional media. It isn't TV, it isn't radio, it isn't press, it isn't posters. Anything else people will call digital, even if it's experiential, even if it's got nothing to do with being online, even if it's product creation, something like that. People tend to think of that as digital. It's like the old stuff that is still very valid, and all over the world there's advertising, you know, the vast majority of advertising appears in the traditional media. And then you have the digital, the social media and all those kind of things, which, you know, people just lump under the umbrella of digital. So in the same way, diversity, I think the first thing people think of with diversity is ethnic diversity. You know, it's certainly the first thing that pops into my mind, partly because I'm not saying that, that gender diversity has been solved, but I'm saying that when you walk around ad agency, you're going to see a lot of women. So it doesn't feel like there is quite such a problem with that. If you walk around a lot of advertising agencies in the UK, and I don't know if this is the case in the US, and I don't know what the percentages and the proportions are, but I still have not seen all or many ethnicities being represented to the same extent as Caucasian. And that, I think, is what a lot of people are talking about. You know, that there are, I don't know if we're allowed to say, you say, because you say African-American, you say Afro-Anglo people, you know, particularly when it comes to the creative department. You don't see many black people in creative departments, many even from the Indian subcontinent. You don't see a lot of people represented from there. You don't see a lot of people from the far eastern part of Asia either in UK creative pumps, as far as I've known. And I don't know the figures that, that would show the extent to which it matches the actual percentages of the population, the proportions of the population. Like, say, the population's 12% black. Are there 12% black people represented in advertising agencies? I don't really know. But what you do have is, you walk into an ad agency, pretty much everyone I've walked into, mainly you're seeing white people there. And I'm talking about agencies that are as woke as Kendall Jenner. You know, they'll talk about it all the time, and yet you don't see them. It may be a supply and demand situation where, let me just take a wild guess, that people perhaps from the Indian subcontinent, you know, if you've worked really hard and you're Indian or Pakistani, you might want to be an engineer. You might want to be a doctor. You might not think advertising is, you know, where I want to really aim my kids' education in the direction of. And so that might be a reason why. There may be lots and lots of reasons why this doesn't happen. But it's definitely the case that in a lot of agencies, the representation of ethnicity is not particularly similar to that that you see in the wider society. Or that's the way I've seen it. And I think the reason why that is thought to be a problem, and I totally agree with this here, is that, you know, when you're putting together creativity that's supposed to speak to an entire country, you want, or perhaps the world, you want influences from as many different parts of that to be put into the mix, into the melting pot, you know, to say, what's it like growing up as a black kid in England? What's it like growing up as someone from China in America? You know, are those things, you know, properly put into the stirring pot of creativity, or even through those lenses? Hey, let's go back to the Kendall Jenner thing. Were there enough people of different ethnicities or backgrounds? Were there, you know, if there had been five Black Lives Matter activists in the whole, you know, process going up the chain, would it have reached the public? You know, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about what those different backgrounds can bring to the piece of work, to the creativity, to improve it somehow. That's what you really, all we're talking about is, how good can the work be? How can it hit people with a bullseye rather than, you know, three circles outside the bullseye, because it's white people hoping that they've got it right in terms of what it's like growing up black on a council estate in Rochdale as opposed to growing up white, you know, in a okay house in Neasden. I don't know. And obviously you can't represent every single person, every single geographical area, and every single ethnic background to the whole thing. But the more you put in, theoretically, the more that stirred pot of creativity is going to mean more things to more people, in theory. I mean, it obviously, so much amazing advertising has happened in the past from white guys who, I don't know if they're middle class or not, but, you know, if you look at Tom and Walt, both with somewhat Irish working class backgrounds, they created some just fucking incredible advertising that hit the absolute bullseye for people all over the world, and definitely in the UK. You know, what they did really hit the spot. So you can't look at that work and go, if only there were some more black and Chinese people involved, that would have been a better ad. Would it? I don't know. But then you may look at the creative department of Abbott Mead Vickers at the time they were working and saying, was that diverse enough? I can tell you from, you know, having been in that department in the late 90s, it was very white. It was very male. And actually, it was quite old. There weren't very many of us who were young, which was the next category I was going to start talking about. Because the diversity element that dare not speak its name, particularly in advertising, is age. You know, there's a huge ageism. If you think of a pyramid, and the higher up you get in terms of your age, the fewer things there are. You're going towards a tiny point. And I wonder if that's getting, that point is getting younger and younger these days. And there's a good reason why it may well get younger and younger. So for anyone not aware, what's different these days is that when you produce an ad, some sort of commercial or whatever, you know, someone's got to send out the tweet about it. Someone's got to write a little Facebook post. Someone's got to do a banner ad. And there's lots of things that go around each ad. So let's just say, for argument's sake, for every ad, there are 10 further elements that have to be done. And they may not be done by the person who does the big old ad. You may have to go and hire some cheap people to write a tweet about it, because it's not, you know, there isn't necessarily the need to have the greatest people in the world to write the tweet. You're just writing a tweet. What's the big deal? So if you're going to have cheap people, inevitably you're going to have young people. And advertising was ageist way before that was a requirement. You know, you want young people because advertising is a sort of neophile industry. You know, they love the young, the new. You know, if you're not young and new, you want to hang around young, new people and hear about what's cool and different and interesting and how the world's moving forward. That's a kind of, you know, inbuilt element to the advertising industry. If you're into creativity in some way, then you've probably got an appetite for, okay, I've seen that, I've done that, what's new, what's next? Show me something different, show me something original, show me something interesting. And there is obviously a feeling that a lot of that could come from, you know, people you don't know and worlds you don't know that kind of show you a whole different thing that you're not aware of. And that, in terms of youth, could be a really, you know, deep resource for that kind of thing. So advertising has always been a bit like that. But now, with a lot more creatives and other people filling in at the bottom to do all this, I guess, poorly paid, not great opportunities kind of work, you're going to get even more young people. And as the money is going to those young people, say, again, for argument's sake, I know people get paid more than this, but say you have 10 young creatives for 100 grand instead of, you know, 250 grand each creatives, you know, you're losing those people, and not even really at the top. I don't want to say exactly what salaries are these days or anything like that, so I'm just using these as examples. But the people who are older, who already got a little bit of bias against them because of the reason I just explained, the neophile parts of the industry. But you also had the fact that they cost more. And people are going, we could have all these guys and maybe one of them will accidentally shoot a bullseye. And then, you know, we've got a lot of quantity needing to get out. So let's pay a bunch of money to get that quantity out. And does the quality matter that much? I don't know. Quality is subjective, isn't it? So you say to your, you look at your finances and you go, if this ad goes out 7.5 out of 10 rather than 8.5 out of 10, does the client mind does the client have the taste to notice? Does the public have the taste to notice? Does it really matter, 8.5 versus 7.5? Especially when it comes down to what is king these days, which is money. When you're saying, here's a crass example on a shoot. Say you go, should we have a cherry picker to do that shot or a helicopter? And you're saying to like the procurement people at the client, we'd really like this ad to have another 50 grand on the budget because we'd really like to have two helicopters and that shot's going to be amazing instead of one cherry picker and that shot's going to be pretty good. And it's impossible to measure the quality of one versus the other or potential quality of one versus the other. You know, back in the day, people just kind of left you to it and you said, well, this is going to cost 700 grand. They go, is it? Okay, well, here's 700 grand. It turns out to be good, hopefully, or very good, hopefully. And you go, yeah, that was worth 700 grand. Now you've got people poring over every element of a budget with a magnifying glass or electron microscope, having a check and saying, you know, do we really need it? Will that really make a difference? We could save 20 grand here, 10 grand there, 5 grand here. Do you need to stay in that hotel? Do you need to fly that airline? Blah, blah, blah. And you look at all those things and they are squeezing and squeezing and squeezing the money down. And if that's the case, you look at all the elements of the money and all the elements of what contributes to the quality. And you go, do we need these expensive people providing these extra marks out of 10 that most people do not care about? That's what we're the situation we're in at the moment. You know, I've written about this a bunch of times on the blog before. This is another version of what happened with the Apple Mac, because once the Apple Mac showed up, I think we had another few years of you know, grace there where no one quite noticed. But then once people realized that you could change a font and a font size and the positioning of a font in literally 5 seconds, as far as, you know, anyone's really concerned. So there's some junior client and you go, oh, I can change that Arial thing to American typewriter. In a second, I could make it like 13.5 point instead of 18 point. I could move it there instead of here. And you know it can be done fairly easily. And what they don't know or care about is the real bit of detail, which will kern it properly, will lead it properly, will make you realize instead of American typewriter, it should be Courier, even though they're very similar. There's going to be a bit of a difference and one's going to feel a bit like this and be consistent with the intention of the ad and the other one isn't. All those bits that people don't really care about. So once everyone knew, you could switch that kind of stuff easily. And then we moved into people being able to edit their own movies on their Mac and all this kind of stuff. People just don't respect it as much anymore. It's really hard also being a copywriter because people write stuff all day. They write their emails every day and they read stuff every day. They read tons of stuff on the internet. And everyone wrote essays at school and they think, you know, I know I can write a decent sentence. And because all these things are subjective, you can't say that is a shit sentence or a wrong sentence. Or why are you using a semicolon there when you should be using an M dash? Or why are you using a comma there when you should be using a colon? Or blah, 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 blah. And then you feel like you're being a pedantic nerd about grammar to people who are like, I don't know, I don't care. Use a dash. I always use a dash. Dashes are fine for me. Never been a problem. Let's use dashes. And why is this nerdy grammar guy annoying me? Why don't you get rid of him? Get some young people in and they'll do my M dashes without annoying me. Let's do that instead. So you get another benefit. You get a quiet, easy, peaceful life. You get an ad, you don't know whether it makes any difference to have an M dash or a colon. No one really knows or cares. And you've saved some money. Win, 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 win. So when it comes to whether an ad agency ought to have two or three very high level experienced creatives who are over 40, over 45, over 50, over 55 there, you know, the answer is often no, let's not do it. Even though those people carry a huge amount of knowledge and experience. And when you get rid of one, you turn the tap off and you lose the ability for them to pass things on to the next generation. You know, I don't know the extent to which people are very, very craft orientated in terms of writing and in terms of art direction. But when I started at AMV, the D&AD copy book with all the best copywriters, you know, I, the privilege I had, five of them were in my agency out of like 32 of all the world's best copywriters. Five of them were in my agency. And then one would leave and another one would show up, or one would leave and two of them would show up. And then when they redid the book, they were even more. When they said, you know, it was people who'd won pencil copy all over. So if I wanted to get my copy better, I could see everyone. It was from the beginning, from David Abbott to Peter Suter to Tony Cox to Mary Weir to Nigel Roberts and Tim Riley. And it was just person after person who were really, really, really fantastic writers. And I sought that out myself because I wanted to improve. And I had the resource there. Now, if you turn up at a lot of agencies these days, they may not have that resource, that ability. Where do you learn? I mean, I'm sure you can find stuff and you can read, and you'll learn definitely by reading the very best stuff and attempting to emulate it, not to copy it, but to emulate the standard that's reached by other people. You know, that's something that can definitely be done. But it's not the same as going, hey, I've written this bit of copy. Would you mind having a look at it for me and, you know, telling me what's wrong with it or how I could improve it? And David Abbott used to do that. You know, David Abbott used to take his copy to people at DDB in America, and then people would take their copy to David Abbott. And you would get really good advice on how to make your stuff better. And that is being lost right now. So when we talk about diversity and whether there's enough women, enough ethnicities, that's cool. Are there enough people of age also providing that perspective? You know, if you read The Ad Contrarian, who I'm sure he won't mind me saying is over 40, you'll see that there are the spending power goes up and up and up. The older you get, the people who have lots and lots of money and choose make decisions on buying cars and make decisions on a lot of expensive purchases are the people who are over 50, over 55, possibly over 60. And they are not being represented in advertising agencies, so they are not being spoken to in a way that, you know, will really hit their bullseye. The other interesting part of ethnic diversity that I think people don't really talk about, because it's kind of weird. If we come from the UK or you come from the US, you come from a country where a lot of people have immigrated into those two countries. And you, if you walk around London or you walk around New York or you walk around LA, and probably several other of the large countries, large cities in those countries, not all of them, but a lot of where the advertising happens, you will see people of every ethnicity. You walk through New York, you'll see people in turbans, definitely African Americans, plenty of Asian people. In England, the number of people from the Indian subcontinent, you'll see just huge, lots of black people as well. It's a, you know, a melting pot. Both of those two countries, to a certain extent, are melting pots. Now, here's the bit that people tend not to mention. Advertising that comes out of, say, Japan or China, or other countries, particularly in Asia and Southeast Asia, not all of them, you know, Singapore is its own melting pot, but within the region, you're going to have no ethnic diversity there at all. You know, there'll be a bit here and there, I imagine, but people in Japan, I'm not aware of stressing or fretting about the lack of ethnic diversity there, partly because they can't really solve it. They can't go, oh, well, we seem to have an office that's 99% Japanese. What are we going to do? We should try and find someone from France or someone from Equatorial Guinea or someone from Azerbaijan. I don't think that's a thought that goes through many Japanese ad agencies, possibly because they don't produce as much global work and they're producing work for their own market. And really, you're trying to get Japanese people to sell to Japanese people, which you'd think make a lot of sense. But if we're saying that there's a primacy in ethnic diversity, you know, because it's not just Asia. South America, there isn't as much of a melting pot either. I mean, in certain countries there are. In Brazil, you've got a lot of influence from Germany and Japan and places like that. But if you took a country like Chile or Colombia, you don't know how, you know, they're going to be people who are Chilean or Colombian. That's how they don't have as much flow of immigration and emigration to offer diversity to them. Does it ruin their advertising? I think you could make a very case to say, It doesn't, but that's because they tend to be advertising kind of to themselves. So does that matter? So it's really the makeup of the country you're in and the proportions that those ethnicities represented that will give you advertising that speaks to as many people as possible and will bring you more original perspectives for your work. But, you know, I think it'd be great if people did discuss more diversity. I think the reason why age isn't talked about as much or with as much sympathy is because, in theory, if you're an advertising person in your 40s or 50s or 60s and you've been in advertising a long time, you've got a bunch of money already. I think there's this image that, hey, you'll have been earning six figures for 5 or 10 or 20 years. You've probably got a house in the south of France, haven't you? You know, what does it matter if you lose your job and we don't have as many of you around? That's not such a problem. Whereas, because ethnic minorities have always seemed to be or had the image of being the downtrodden people in a society, or the people who find it harder to make a way because they don't kind of stepping stones and bridges already built, there's a lot more sympathy about that. And the same went for women. Women have often had to try and, you know, make their way beyond what the male patriarchy was willing to give them, whether it was the vote or anything else. So women downtrodden, they've got a much better place now. Ethnic minorities, same thing, but we need to think about them. Age, no one gives a shit. And I don't think the sympathy is there. The reason it's not there is for slightly perverse reasons. And I think the funny thing is, everyone goes into advertising and doesn't even think about that. That's going to be a problem. You go, hey, my life's cool. I'm 25. I'm in advertising. Or I'm 32. I'm 33. Whatever. What are you going to do when you're in your mid 40s or your mid 50s? How is that going to work? And people just, I don't know. They must sort of go off somewhere else to do something else. But no one's sitting there going,
yeah. So it's called, we really need to protect advertising. So creativity is our weapon.
For good reasons. Let's use it.
So that was
if you go on to campaignlive.com, diversity thing I wanted to talk about.
Be able to find the third thing, if you put that in, where you put Ian Hartfield's,
you'll find it.
Article in
campaign. And I can just read a little bit out for you.
Let me just get it up on my computer. And then I can
what he's saying, I 100% agree with. I think, well, the overall crux of it, that it would be great if we were bringing positive things into the world. You know, we have a responsibility and an ability to bring those things in. It would be a good idea if we did that, and that would produce better advertising and would, you know, make the world a better place for some people. Okay, so let me read a little bit out for you. Recently, I had the pleasure of hearing the brilliant Richard Curtis speak at our company meeting. Just taking a little pause on the side here. What are BBH's company meetings all like? Wow, Richard Curtis comes and speaks, and that's pretty cool. I don't know if that was a little off-site thing or whatever. I'll just mention here, I hold Richard Curtis in enormously high regard for Blackadder and for Make Poverty History. And I got to say, I liked Four Weddings and Notting Hill when they came out. And what he did with Make Poverty History is just astonishing. He's an incredible bloke, so well done him. So he's saying, as well as giving insights on how we wrote some of the best comedy this country has ever produced, he says something that struck me, that's Ian, as particularly profound. When asked how he felt about the then upcoming events in the US, he paused and said his great hope was that the next few years will see an explosion of art, music and comedy because creativity needs an enemy. Curtis cited Margaret Thatcher and everything she stood for as the catalyst for himself, Ben Elton, Rowan Atkinson et al., to express themselves and their beliefs through great comedy. And boy, do we have an enemy now. If Thatcher's years produced The Smiths, With Nail and I, Blackadder, etc., how exciting is it to see what the Donald Trump era will produce? This is backed up by science. A study produced in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology demonstrated that anger was better at promoting unstructured thinking on a creative task when compared with a neutral mood. A second experiment elicited anger directly in the subjects before asking them to brainstorm ways of improving the condition of the natural environment. Angry people generated more ideas. So that was the bit that I'm not sure about. Let me explain why. I've known this theory since I was at university, because people would routinely say that the Nixon era was what produced the great movies of the 1970s. You know, it was a fantastic, and they're saying the paranoia and the dissatisfaction and the need to express art that went up against things like Nixon were the things that made that incredible art at that time. I can't speak for the other art forms. I mean, in my opinion, the late 60s and early 70s were the best for music. But was it because of that? I'm not really sure, because a lot of it's
British. And when this is where this starts to get conflated, because, you know, we're talking about Margaret Thatcher versus Donald Trump. If you're really comparing Donald Trump, what you'd be saying is that the 80s explosion or whatever in art and comedy or whatever Richard Curtis was talking about was a reaction to Ronald Reagan. Because the UK has its own problems right now. You know, what's happening with Brexit and Theresa May and the utter abject collapse of the Labour Party as an effective opposition is shit on its own. It's a really, really terrible, difficult situation for a lot of people. And the division of the country, pretty much in half, for people who think we should leave the European Union, some of whom voted for that on the basis of some pretty dodgy and flimsy evidence. The UK's got a lot of shit to deal with on its own. Donald Trump, I'm not in the UK right now. I'm in the US, and we have Donald Trump front and centre, of course. And so I can't speak for people in the UK right now and how much they feel Donald Trump is about to ruin their lives or has ruined their lives or whatever it's going to be. But there's plenty of shit to go up against in the UK right now. So if it's Donald Trump, that could be, you know, a big thing. Could be something that inspires a lot of people. Okay, I get that. But I don't quite... this doesn't really make sense to me. I get the fact that Richard Curtis produced some great work in the 80s and Ben Elton produced some great work in the 80s, and I loved it, and I lived through that, and it was amazing, and it felt actually of its time. Well, the young ones did anyway. I wouldn't say Blackadder did, but it was brilliant. And there was a lot of other good stuff around that time. Not 9 o'clock News was pretty awesome as well. But here's a big but for me. If the 1980s was such a, it was an era that was fueled so much by people's dissatisfaction with what was going on in the world, how come the movies were so shit? I mean, if you want to name 10 great movies of the 1980s, you struggle a little bit. It was not a great era. The best movie made in the 1980s by a country mile was Raging Bull. And that was made in 1980. So that was made off the end of the Carter era. Or if you really want to stretch this to be English, more of the Callaghan era, just before we got into Thatcher. So if everything was reacting to Thatcher at that time, why weren't there as many good movies? There were some good movies. I'm not at all denying that. But it was nothing like the heyday of the 70s. And in fact, the fact that there's a book called Easy Riders, Raging Bulls is because there are thought to be bookends of the late 60s, like 69 to, say, 79, 80. That was the golden era. And so once you started getting to the 80s, the 80s wasn't thought to be great. And people weren't banging their heads against the person in charge. People weren't going, oh, fucking hell, Reagan's in charge. We're all screwed. I think there's a bit of revisionism saying that Reagan was a great president, or at least compared to the situation that maybe we have now, at least from some people's perspective. But in the 80s, there was money sloshing around all over the place. Of course, not for everybody, but it was a decade of plenty for a lot of people. Again, I'm not saying for everybody, but it didn't feel like a decade that was stricken by, you know, a terrible paranoia and evil people leading the country. You know, in retrospect, I think that became a bit clearer when people saw what Thatcher had been doing, and, you know, perhaps looking at what Reagan had done at that time, it wasn't very good. But it doesn't quite hold water. The movies were shit, and the music was pretty shit as well, to be perfectly honest. And so I don't think great art really did get produced, or certainly no better than the 70s. And then look at the 90s. So in 92, Bill Clinton took over, and in 1990, I believe, or was that 92? No, John Major started in about 89 and then was in charge for about 97. There were a lot of good movies done then when there wasn't this awful thing in charge. My memory of the early 90s in terms of what it was like for art produced in England was it was a particularly moribund time. It was not a time where really a lot of great stuff was happening. In my memory, it's entirely subjective. But, you know, you had some great stuff being produced in America. Schindler's List, you know, The Age of Innocence, Goodfellas was produced during George H.W. Bush's time. See, there's lots of things. And then you can take it up right to the end of the 90s and go, look, Being John Malkovich, Three Kings, Magnolia. There were loads of great movies, Saving Private Ryan. There were loads of great movies, you know, put out during the Clinton era. And I don't think anyone was particularly knocked at the Clinton era. I mean, he may have had his affair or whatever, but it certainly wasn't, you know, anything like Watergate. So then you had movies that were very good in a time of relative satisfaction. And then you can go into the 2000s and you can say, oh, wow, we were all let down by the entry into the Iraq War and the fact that it was all based on lies and that was all bullshit. So we must have been pissed off then. Maybe that produced some good movies. But, you know, Eternal Sunshine, The Spotless Mind came out under George W. Bush, and, you know, things like Adaptation. And there were a fair few decent movies at the beginning of the 2000s. And at the end of George W. Bush's time, you had No Country for Old Men. You had There Will Be Blood. Good work happened under George Bush, but no sort of better or worse than happened under Clinton. And then Obama took over, and, you know, there were still some very good movies done between 2008 and 2016. I wonder if either the 70s part of it has been overstated as the fuel and the generator for great work in terms of it being a dissatisfactory time for a lot of people. And maybe it was just those people were coming up. If you have the fire and drive of Spielberg, Coppola, Scorsese, De Palma, all doing things at once, John Milius, you know, and that produced, it was a golden era, and they're all feeding off each other, and they're all really great friends, and they were producing their best stuff, and then started to make kind of shittier stuff into the next decade. It's sort of interesting, isn't it? Was it just the 70s happened to have produced some great shit, or did they produce great shit because of Nixon? I don't know, because it doesn't hold water. It doesn't hold water at all. There are good and bad movies made in any of those eras, and it's really only the 70s that holds up as a consistent period of time where there was just some fantastic stuff coming out that was intelligent, that was informed, and seemed to be a response to the political situation of that time. Now, I'm not going to argue with Richard Curtis. If he felt at the time in the 80s he was writing the gags in Blackadder 2 better because Thatcher was in charge, then I'm in no way going to argue with that. It doesn't feel like Blackadder 2 and 3 were much of a reaction. It felt like The Young Ones was a reaction to that, and not 9 o'clock news reaction to that. It didn't feel like Blackadder. Blackadder could have come out of all sorts of eras, in my very, very, very humble opinion, that isn't based on anything at all. But it's obviously not of it's not contemporary Blackadder. And there may have been jokes that and situations that we could all relate to as people living in the 80s. Sure. Yeah, that's I'm not arguing with that. But it wasn't of its time in the way that The Young Ones was. And, you know, as much as there were plenty of stuff, there wasn't plenty of really, really good stuff. Not enough for you to go, the 80s was a great, great era. So Ian's point that we're about to go into a tricky situation politically on both sides of the Atlantic, and then will that hopefully produce some amazing work, or you know, more specifically in what Ian's saying, some positive work. We have, you know, the tools or the palette and the paintbrushes available, and we can be responsible for bringing out the good stuff. That's cool, but you know, if you bring us down to advertising, it makes even less sense. There were some very good ads in the 80s. Sure, there were some amazing ads in the 90s. You know, if you look at things like Dunlop Unexpected, that was made when John Major was right in the middle of his very boring reign. And there were loads of other great ads. If you look in the D&ADs of 93, 94, amazing stuff, tons of amazing stuff. Was that a response to John Major's incredibly boring premiership? I really doubt it. And then, you know, again, this is when Clinton was in charge as well. So Clinton's in charge. And then you go all the way up to Guinness Surfer at that kind of time as well. So great work is being made, again, under an era where people are relatively satisfied and perfectly happy. And there was some, you know, everything up to Cadbury's Gorilla was made all through George W. Bush's time. And therefore, through the time of Tony Blair, as that particular government started to sour a little bit. And so you have all these times when advertising has produced some really, really great stuff. What I'd say now, if I was going to be, you know, take a look at it and see if there was a trend, I'd say kind of since Obama took over, or, you know, since Gordon Brown took over from Tony Blair, and then David Cameron and his really dreadful Tory government took over as well in 2010, it doesn't feel like there's been much great stuff as a response to that. I mean, I think people, particularly liberal people, were generally very happy to live under Obama's leadership, particularly in America. That was all fine. But when you look at what was happening in the UK, we had a terrible government, you know, impressing austerity on all sorts of people and looking like they wanted to kill the NHS. And the late years of Blair's premiership and Gordon Brown's little couple of years, they were pretty poor. And I think what we've had in the time since then in UK advertising has not been a golden era at all. And I don't know if that's anything to do with the political climate. I have my guesses that it probably isn't, because there have been decent advertising all the way through. And the reasons why it hasn't been so good since about 2008-09, I think, is down to a lot of other factors in terms of, you know, finances and the explosion of different media and the way those two things feed into each other and what it means that's left. There's less money and less resources to make the kind of things that really impressed us back in the 80s and 90s. And here we are. That's that situation. Has it got anything to do with David Cameron or Barack Obama or anything like that? I'd say that's a harder thing to argue. But either we're saying that the political climate feeds into art, or we're saying it doesn't, or we're saying it does to an extent that you can tell. You know, Nixon left this imprint on people at that time, and they felt the need to go and make certain films in a certain way. And is that true? You know, you can make a case for that, but you just can't through the 80s and 90s and early 2000s and now. There's not enough consistency about whether there was a great purple patch under an arsehole. Or a great purple patch under an arsehole. A great purple patch under someone who was a leader who, you know, did an unsatisfactory job of it. I think the being led into Iraq in 2003 through lies was our Watergate. You know, if you were of my generation, that was your Watergate. That was when you felt betrayed. That was when, if you were one of the million or so people who marched through London going, this war is not going to happen in my name, but, you know, obviously it just happened. And people, we all knew it was a lie and all bullshit. And just to get the money for the oil and that kind of stuff. That was our Watergate. But people didn't seem to mind. People didn't seem to mind, I think, because there was money in the pocket. And, you know, you could express your dissatisfaction with this, but Tony Blair was just going to lead us into war anyway. Not just Tony Blair. Loads of people. The Economist thought we should go to war. It was all bullshit. And was there a reaction to that? Not that I saw. So that's the third part of what I wanted to talk about. I think, are we able to react to our circumstances in terms of how much it makes us produce great art? I don't know. I mean, the other funny thing is the best art in history was produced under the patronage of people like the Medicis, or, you know, people involved in the Roman Catholic Church in the Vatican. They provided a lot of money for great artists and great work got made. I don't know if it was a period of particular turmoil or if World War II produced amazing work, but it just doesn't look like there's a particular correlation between bad things happening in terms of the people in charge and great things happening in work as a response. So I don't necessarily agree with that. So what did we have? We had the Pepsi thing, and how on earth did that come about? I've no idea. We've got the diversity thing. People talk about it in certain ways and not in others, and that's almost as bad. Diversity is only a problem when it comes to these categories. No, nope, it's a problem for all sorts of categories, and not just a problem because of morality, it's a problem because of how it feeds into the work and whether the work's good or not. And then, yeah, politics and advertising. So those are my three blog posts that I just couldn't be asked to write. So instead I've sat in my wardrobe talking into my Mac for the best part of an hour for your benefit, if you're sitting here around the Easter holidays going, fuck, the Easter holidays are boring. I don't know what you really do with them. And it's not like there's a proper thing where, you know, you have Christmas dinner or whatever like that. Easter's a bit shit and there's a bank holiday and blah, blah, blah. So in America, we don't seem to do that much at all anyway. So if you have been at a loose end and you've wanted an hour of someone wittering on about advertising to fill up some of your time over this slightly underwhelming inverted commas holiday, or your stuff from eggs, then glad to have been of some sort of help. Hopefully normal service will be resumed next week I'll line up someone else to have a chat with, and we can go back to a podcast that isn't just me. In the meantime, lots of love. Hope to speak to you soon. Bye.